What's up, guys? Welcome back to Rebranded Safety. In this week's episode, we're talking all about how to create a culture of belonging in your business. Doesn't that sound good? Let's get into the podcast.
Health and safety is almost a victim of its own success.
We're in an oppressive regime of health and safety regulations.
A huge fire engulfs a tower block in London.
Children being forced to wear goggles to play conkers at school.
Worst oil field disaster, 164 dead.
Rebranding Safety, the modern health and safety podcast, crushing the stereotype. Brought to you by Risk Fluent and your host, James McPherson. Welcome back to Rebranding Safety, everybody. Rebranding Safety does exactly what it says on the tin. We're here to rebrand health and safety. We're here to challenge the perception. We're here to challenge those over-the-top health and safety gone mad practices. We're here to provide you with free conversations, free guidance, free support. So feel free to kind of get in depth with all of our back catalogue. Go and check out all the amazing conversations we've got. Don't forget to go and check us out on YouTube as well. If you're listening on a podcast, we provide bite-sized videos on anything to how to have a career in health and safety, to how to manage manual handling. So there's everything you could ever need, all provided in a modern, entertaining manner on Rebranding Safety. So this week we're talking all about how to create a culture of belonging. So today's guest is dialing all the way in from America. He's the founder and chief belonging architect at Rudiment Solutions, a people empowerment company that works with individuals and organizations to thrive in all things people, process, and profits. Now, isn't that a tagline? Our guest served in the US Navy, done time in corporate world, leading him to write in his book, The Belonging Factor. Make sure you listen to the end of this podcast for a free giveaway of a copy of this book. That's right, a free giveaway. If you listen to the end, you'll find out how you can get a free copy of this book. So thank you very much to today's guest. His name is Devin Halliday. Let's get into the podcast. So Devin, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for coming on.
Oh, it's a great, great time to be here. I really appreciate the invitation. Look forward to having a good talk, man.
Yeah, first American guest, I think. I'm thinking back. Yep, first American guest from America.
First American from America. All right, that's me.
Okay, so I want to kind of just read in about you, obviously, and kind of there was one kind of paragraph that stood out in the kind of research and the content and stuff that you'd sent me and I'd seen. And just kind of probably touch on that really briefly, and then maybe you could just tell us about your story. But kind of just to put a bit of context to the podcast then, like within health and safety, as you know, it's a primarily health and safety podcast. And we talk about culture all the time, culture. And I think a lot of us don't really understand what that is or how many different millions cogs go into that thing that creates this elusive culture. And like I said, there was one thing that you wrote that really struck a chord with me. And most organizations have well-written, well-intentioned culture value statements. They review them at big meetings, plaster them on walls and buildings, designed to inform how the brand and people behave. They're intended to have a positive impact on people, process, profit. The problem, a staggering majority of them are bullshit, which for me, I just love that when I read it. So... That just kind of puts in context for the listeners, I think, how this conversation is going to go. But why don't you dive in and tell us how you came to be you, what you do, and your story.
Yeah, man. So I came to be me courtesy of both of my amazing parents. That was a wonderful thing that happened. I had no choice in that, but I'm glad it did happen. Right. So I'll work through the process here. So I know you mentioned I was in the Navy, here in the U.S. Navy, and that was a pivotal piece for me because growing up, I was always attending air shows and seeing the, you know, the Navy Blue Angels fly their fancy fighter jets, and, you know, the movie Top Gun came out, all those things that made me go, oh, man, this is a place for me. So what did I end up doing? I ended up joining the Navy and going to this place because I had an idea from a young kid. That's where I belonged. And, you know, talking about safety, man, working on the flight deck of an aircraft carrier is a very, very unsafe place to be. But the Navy has done a great job at putting processes in place to help create as much safety as you can in such a hazardous work environment. I mean, to the point where even when we were in the Gulf and it was 130 degrees outside, plus you're on the flight deck with all the heat from the jet exhaust, they were running us on, you know, 20-minute shifts, and then we'd have to go hydrate and take a break, right? So good stuff there. But what I realized in the Navy was that as cool as all of the high-performance aircraft and everything were, it was still the military, and we still went out and, you know, executed our missions. And our missions often included things that maybe didn't align with my values, right? We were doing things for geopolitical reasons, and they didn't necessarily agree with me. And so while much of the decision-making was all about my pay grade, I had a decision I could make within my pay grade, and that was to choose to move on from the Navy and into, you know, something else. Didn't know what that was going to be. Spent the next 18 years of my career in the corporate world, and was predominantly in sales operations, and leadership positions. And that's where I really developed this idea and understanding across the entire organization. It didn't matter the function, whether it was a facilities and maintenance function, or it was a sales or executive leadership function, there often was this big disalignment with the values that were stated versus what was actually lived in practice. And it showed up in so many different little ways. And I began really this journey when I got into leadership in that company of trying to understand what makes people tick. How are people motivated? What gives people a sense of purpose and trust of their organization, and allows them to be willing to share ideas, to give feedback, to innovate and collaborate together to actually get shit done, right? Because the bureaucratic process just was not getting it done. So that's really kind of what's informed up until this point, where then I decided that there was a next phase for me, and that was going out on my own, founding this company, Rudiment Solutions, and creating these cultures within businesses where the things that they say are important are the things that they actually do and live in their values through behaviors and actions, not just through fancy statements and then a bunch of garbage in between.
That there's something you said in there I kind of want to jump on. That kind of, you seem to have that a really good kind of self-awareness to be able to acknowledge in the Navy that their values are not aligned to your values. How did you go about like knowing your values? Like, I think that's something quite easy to say, but how does somebody actually do that? Because I think to be able to be a good leader, I suppose you have to know yourself first.
So I would say unquestionably to be authentic as a leader, and we'll probably talk about that word a bit because it is a word that gets, you know, very commonly used. But to be authentic, you have to know yourself. You have to be able to be self-aware and self-analyze and understand your faults and your opportunities, as well as those things that are strengths of yours. Because also any strength can become, in the wrong situation, it can become a you know, liability of yours if you don't know how to use it or manage it the right way, right? And so that's all, you know, all a big part of it. But to answer your question of finding my values, that's been a deep and long journey. But in that moment, that was one of the early professional moments for me where I said, you know, we have all these planes leaving the deck of our aircraft carrier, and I know that they are not on practice runs, that they are on missions, and they're leaving with thousands and thousands of pounds of armament, and they're coming back empty. And, you know, we had access to news and other things, and so I kind of knew what was going on the other end of that mission. And for me, it never dawned on me, and I don't know why, but it never dawned on me when I was super fascinated about these high performance aircraft and working with them that you know, I was in the military, and the military's job is to complete its mission. And when its mission started to involve the taking of life for geopolitical reasons, that was the part for me where it just hit me hard that this didn't feel right with me. I'd never been an activist or anything like that to where I was like, oh yeah, you know, killing people to make money off of oil is bad. But then when you start to see that that's kind of what's happening here, for me, that was a moment where I went, okay, this is value, you know, and I identified it in that moment that I didn't want to be a part of that type of environment, right? And not that it was anything bad, or not that it was anything that shouldn't have a purpose or place in the world at the right times. Just for me, it wasn't the place for me.
So it wasn't so much, you know, being born and raised around a sentence that is your value. It was just that kind of gut feeling you had in that moment of that this just doesn't feel right for me personally. And I suppose it's acknowledging that.
Yeah.
Jumping on it and making a decision.
For sure. And, you know, if I go back, probably my values were shaped by things that I was taught growing up, I'm sure, right?
Of course,
and
yeah.
So I grew up in Northern California. So for those who are listening around the world that aren't familiar with kind of the what Northern California is known for here in America is being very progressive, fairly liberal-minded, and being and progressive as far as diversity and inclusion and equity and it's called a hippie tree hugger community, right? There's a lot of folks who are very just kind of in tune with Mother Nature and all that stuff, rather than in tune with commercialism, capitalism, and those things. So it's interesting that I've kind of moved into this commercial and capital world, but I've held these values as part of it, and they show up in different ways. And one of those first ways that hit me professionally was the story I shared with you.
Two ways to go. I want to talk about your book, and I want to talk about leadership, like you say. So maybe we start with your book, and I bet we'll come on to leadership. So
I imagine we might.
So you've wrote a book. Your book's called Belonging Factor. At what point, you know, what took you to that book? You know, so you've left the Navy, you've gone into your corporate world, you've started your own business, you've got your own values. At what point did you go, do you know what, I could do a book on this? And what was kind of the aim behind the book, if that makes sense?
Yeah, man. So great question. And you know, for everybody listening, everybody has their lived experiences and their stories, right? And those things that inform kind of who they are and what they're about. And you make decisions about what the important things are. And so for me, over the course of my time with Verizon, the company I was with for 18 years, it really was evident in my developed leadership style that it was about people first and what people wanted to accomplish for themselves and in their lives, and the differences that they had within the environment of a team, and how to bring all those things together to help that be a motivator to deliver business outcomes. So you know, you start doing things a little differently. You stop worrying about the exact result that you're working to get, and you start worrying about the people that are employed to get the result, right? And as a leader, you know, it's easy to look at reports and look at data and walk through a building and point out everything that people are doing wrong that doesn't align with a standard. What's just as easy, but far more important, is to look at data and let it guide a little bit about what your conversations are going to be like with the people you're going to talk to. And walk through a building, and when you see stuff that is happening against whatever the policy or procedure is, instead of pointing it out, usually people know. You kind of ask, hey, so why are we doing it this way? And you become a curious person, and then you start to learn more about people and what's driving them to do the things they're doing. And they're innovating usually when it's something is against kind of the standard operating procedure. And so as opposed to looking at it as a negative, look at it as an opportunity to learn about what you can do from it. So that really informed a big part for me about how I approached everything I was doing within my teams. So then when I started my business, here was the pivotal moment, man. So my dad passed away unexpectedly from heart attack just last year, and I was still with my company then, my corporate job, And it was one of those moments where just kind of taking stock of life and what's going on in life and what's happening and what's the value that I'm bringing. And so for me, that was a moment where I really wanted to just honor something that my dad used to always teach me, which is just work hard and stay true to yourself and good things are going to happen, right? And so I started writing out all this stuff that I'd been doing, all these processes I've been doing, all of these theories that I've either developed or kind of modified and prescribed to and modified. And in working with one of my mentors, I just shared some of the stuff I was working on. He said, dude, you got to write a book. People need to know this. They need to hear this. They need to hear it in your voice and your perspective. And so that's why I started with, everybody who has these values or these processes or these systems or these thoughts in their head, they have something that they could put to paper, that they could share with others, and maybe even have a book in them to help others learn from the things that they're passionate about and the things that work well in the world that they're in. So for me, it was that moment where I just said, all right, I'm not a writer, but I'll do this thing. And let's try it. Let's see what it's about. And it's been received so, so well. Just this morning, I was reading comments on social media of people who I don't know just talking about the book or talking about me, which is weird that somehow now I'm like this. It's a pseudo public figure to where people talk about me. They tag me, fortunately, so I can see it. But I'm sure there's other people talking that don't tag me in those social media posts. I don't know what they're saying.
You're famous. You're famous in social media world.
Yeah, well, I hope not.
Yeah, good point. There's so much you said there, but that you kind of... It's such a good conversation, I think, when we're talking about kind of leadership and that kind of culture or developing a culture. But there's one thing you said in there about kind of when your mentor said about, you've got to write this book from your perspective and your language. And I think like the leadership games, so like consultants on leadership and people that teach CEOs, etc., on leadership is quite a popular market at the moment. There's a lot of people writing a lot of books, doing a lot of content, etc. And you said about writing it from your perspective and your language. Do you think that's important to get that kind of diversity of people's interpretations on leadership? Or do you think there is too many people in that game at the moment?
Yeah. So, there's a famous saying that everything's already been written. Now it's just being rewritten. Right. Mm-hmm. When it comes to this game. And I don't subscribe to that philosophy. So are there a lot of people in the game? Yeah. And are there people in the game because it's what they grew up knowing, in their professional life, and they do it because it's a job and pays the bills? Yeah. And are there companies that maybe don't have the best motivation or intention in working with a leader or an organization because they're just trying to extend, a contract for as long as they can to get as much as they can out of it over extended period of time? Yeah, those exist. But then if the real test here is, and this is the important part, is to really start to identify what your values are aligned around integrity or aligned around gratitude or aligned around safety. And then find somebody to work with who supports and shares that same alignment of values. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's a lot of voices in the game, but for me, coming at it from the perspective I came at this, I'm certainly not the first person to talk about the idea of belonging or workplace cultures. But I do believe that everybody has a voice and a perspective to add. And for me, I'm an avid collector of information and resources. I love to learn about successful people, successful organizations, and successful personal histories. And so as a result, I end up getting a lot of different perspectives on the same set of information. And that's super helpful when it comes to making decisions as a leader. Thinking about health and safety, and just kind of this idea of maybe you're a leader in that space. You're listening to this right now. And you've got protocols, right? You've got what's written as the scripture, so to speak, of how things have to happen. And some of that is legally mandated, and I understand that. And maybe we can do away with some of the BS legal mandates. But there's also stuff that's policy or just kind of internally driven. And so as a leader, what I find to be the most important skill you can do in kind of developing this muscle of being curious is talk to your people, talk to the people who are operating equipment or the people who are working in an environment, get their feedback, because the reality is they're so much closer to it than you are. And if somebody's doing something just slightly out of regulation, it's worth inquiring as to why. And you might have a problem you have to fix, or you might have a new solution to solve something even bigger because of the way this person has invented or innovated approaching their work.
So to get to that kind of, I agree with what you're saying. I've said for a long time, you know, the power of why, that just that one word of saying, oh, why are you doing it like that? What you can come to either a point of learning for yourself or a point of learning for that person. Either way, someone's going to learn, which is amazing. I think the one problem, especially in the UK, what we have is having that creating that culture, which is probably a great point to kind of start talking about your book as a belonging culture, but creating that culture where somebody feels comfortable. So me as a machine operator, for example, feel comfortable to explain why, as opposed to going, oh shit, sorry, I'll just do it how I'm supposed to do it. So how do we create that kind of, like your book's called The Belonging Factor. What is a belonging culture? How do we create that comfortable environment?
Yeah, man. So let's get down to it. So trust is ultimately one of the most critical foundations of a culture of belonging. Trusting that your direct supervisor, whoever that may be, maybe your direct supervisor is a CEO, it doesn't matter, that your direct supervisor is honest, has integrity, is fair, is open, is, you know, all of the things really go into that core underlying trust, right? That they're going to do what they say that they do what they say, and they walk the talk. And so as a leader in building that, is there are so many moments where you can erode trust and not even realize it as a leader. One of them is you know, saying you're going to do something and not do it because you got busy or whatever else, but that's fine as long as you acknowledge with the person that, hey, you know, this, the timeline's going to move, or oh, I'm not going to actually be able to get to it because this, and acknowledge that. So I mean, that's a critical one, but so trust is a big one. Being authentic as a leader, knowing your values, knowing what's important to you, knowing that there are clear standards, and explaining very clearly what they are, working with your team to make sure that the team can articulate back the importance of those standards. But then here's the big one. You want to build some sort of a sense of alignment of the core important values to the organization, to the leader, and to the employees. And one of the best ways to do that is to empower others, to champion others' ideas, to create a system where people don't feel, like you said, that, oh shit, what did I do wrong? Fine, yeah, no problem, boss, I'll get back to it. But instead feel empowered to give that answer. So it could start with some things as, you know, anonymous suggestion boxes if people are in some way mistrusting, right? That's one way that you can kind of get the process started. As long as you take action on those things publicly, acknowledging them, and that'll start to bring that sense of trust in. If a person recoils instantly in that whole, like, oh shit, you know, am I in trouble moment, that should be an indicator to you as a leader that there is this fear in your leadership to that person, that they are compliant out of fear rather than in some way collaborative with what you're trying to achieve. So it often starts as basic as the approach, right? You know, hey, why are you doing that? You know, maybe that simple approach. Yeah, I know you asked why, and that's what we just told you to do, is ask why. But the way you approach it, I mean, it's, we're talking some real basic human behavior elements that go into this sense of belonging. But as a leader, you have to be authentic in yourself, so that you have to know yourself. You have to build a community and collaborative effort by people, by empowering them to share their ideas, by not just asking when things are wrong what the issue is, but asking when things are right, so you can share those things well, and just acknowledging when they're right. That's the other piece that I would tell you most commonly. Let's say you're walking a shop floor and you've got, you know, 50 machine operators all around, and everything is going perfectly. Don't just keep walking. Take the time to tell every single person that what they're doing is amazing and thank you for doing it. right? That right there is one of the critical elements that will continue to build that empowerment.
I love that. I spoke a while ago to a local colleague actually on the podcast, and we were talking about, you know, there's one thing I've said for a long time that in health and safety we should treat people like I treat my dog. Now that normally gets attention, which is good because that's what I'm trying to do. But the point is that when I'm training my dog, he gets positive reinforcement. He gets treats every time he does stuff. It's we're moving away from that old fashioned saying that we have in the UK that good is expected, and bad is spoken about. And I think we're still there. And within health and safety, we're stuck in that old fashioned mindset. We walk around saying, you're doing this wrong, you're doing that wrong. Why aren't we? And I think I actually said in a podcast, embrace our inner Americans and go around and start high fiving people, not to kind of stereotype, but, you know, to be.
I got to ask a question. is that the stereotype that in like the work environment in America, we're walking around like giving high fives?
I don't think it is. No.
You've got to answer the question.
What I meant by that was that in England, we have this stiff upper lip. Right. Yeah. And yeah, we are sure. Very insular. We are very prim and proper. And I think we still have that now, and we're getting more out of it. But I find personally that Americans are a lot more outward, a lot more verbal, a lot more vocal. You know, they're okay with the kind of public display of affection and high fives and stuff like that. In England, especially in a work environment, I think you'd struggle for stuff like that, to have that kind of walk around and be like, oh, great work, man. That's awesome stuff. You wouldn't get that in England. You would, because good is expected. That's what I meant by that.
It's fine to expect good, but don't treat it like it's an expectation as a leader to your employees, right? So like in what I say by it's fine to expect good, I operate with this understanding that as an employer to an employee relationship, you're in a contract essentially, right? The employer has said, in exchange for you doing a good job at all of these things that you've agreed to do, I'm going to pay you on time. And you know, when you have people who show up and do a shit job, the company doesn't show up and give you shit wages. You still get paid, right? And so I do believe to say good is expected, it's at the most fundamental. I don't know that anything is wrong with that, because there is that contractual exchange already happening, right? I didn't walk into the interview and say, hey, listen, I'm going to do a shit job if you hire me, as long as you still pay me the same amount, and then get hired. That didn't happen. I walked in and I told you all the things that I'm great at and how I'm going to do all this great stuff for you. Is it reasonable to expect good? I do think it's reasonable to expect that, but that doesn't underscore or that doesn't remove the ability to walk around just only telling people when things are wrong. Okay. And so here's what I'll tell you. It's so funny you said the high-fiving thing. I'm like notorious for that. I walk around all the time high-fiving people. I'm like, dude, that is awesome. Tell me more about why you made that decision. And they're like, well, I thought you were going to be mad, but I did this and this, this. And I'm like, why would I be mad? You took initiative to do something and try to solve a problem that I didn't even know was a problem. That's rad. Like, thank you so much. High five. And they're like, yeah, but it didn't work. I'm like, okay, well, let's figure it out. You know, it's like taking that type of approach. It takes so much energy to be a jerk, you know. It requires the use of muscles and nerves in your body that don't get used when you're being cool, when you're being happy, when you're feeling good. So you know, that's the part. If that's embrace your inner American, do it all day, man.
Yeah, it must be. They're infectious, though, aren't they? Like, if you as a leader, surely I'm walking around being miserable, being fear based. You did this wrong. You did that wrong. That's infectious, and that spreads its way through the business. But then if you're going around exactly what you said,
man.
Sorry.
In the business, what happens when you go home after you've just been getting beat up, or not even you, but your colleagues, and you go home to your family, and you're in this bad mood, and you know, you just want to you maybe make the decision to go drink to take care of your sorrows, or maybe you isolate yourself or whatever, but it affects them too. I mean, it's such a ripple effect. Versus to your point, I guess you were probably going the other side of that where you get positive reinforcement, you get encouragement, you feel like you have a voice that matters, or like just at the very least that, hey, I'm doing good, and they see it, right?
Yeah.
You don't go home with that. So maybe you don't go home high-fiving your kids, but you still go home in a different way, and you bring yourself there in a different way to those other people who are so important to your life, right? And the coworkers, of course, because what happens in a work environment where the boss is a jerk? Everybody's grumbling and nobody's as productive as they could be. And then sometimes because people are grumbling or not paying attention or their mind is somewhere else, they make a mistake or there's a safety concern that could potentially come up because of being distracted. So you can actually, as a leader in a safety world, you can actually have a detrimental impact to safety by being a dick.
Yeah, no, you can 100%. I've been saying for a while, you know, when people say, oh, you know, what's one of the biggest problems with health and safety is we can't get the right people. I said, just stop employing dickheads then. Just stop. And so it's just much easier said than done. No, it's not. I know within 5 minutes of talking to someone, nah, you're a dick. I don't want you to work for me. and that's it. But there's something, what you were talking about there kind of reminded me about a little story of like a load of people. I can't remember what they called it, but I was reading a book by Matthew Syed, his newest one called Rebel Ideas. It's all about diversity, which you actually talk about a lot in your book as well. Yeah. But it's kind of diversity of people and diversity of ideas. And I just kind of want to bring that, and that kind of bit that you were talking about kind of reminded me that people being scared to speak up and say, I'm not sure about this. And they were basically telling us about this story of this team that was a very hierarchically based team. So I'm the leader, don't question my authority, that's it. And actually it turns out that somebody within the team had spotted something that was a serious problem, but because they were just the tourist, for example, you know, just a mountain climber, not the guide, they didn't say something. And Matthew Syed talks about like the power of kind of diversity within the teams and being able to be comfortable to talk about. And that's kind of thought, let's talk about diversity from your point of view within a belonging factor or a belonging culture.
Yeah, so, you know, within a belonging culture, I look at diversity from a few ways. So many organizations, particularly here in the U.S., are really working hard to build a team of diversity. And it's measured in a couple of very rudimentary ways. The term people of color is used here to define, in the U.S., hiring people who are non-white. So there's a POC ratio, and then there's a gender ratio. So how many women versus men in these positions? And then there's a few others, you know, anybody with a disability, anybody with, you know, a veteran status, military veteran status. But those are kind of, you know, still secondary to these other two things. But so for me, when I think about gender and I think about, you know, maybe racial or ethnic background, what I'm really thinking about is what are the lived experiences or stories or education that these people have that they can bring into the team, right? Because somebody looks different in their skin color or looks different in their gender, for me, doesn't mean that diversity is in some way something that adds value just in and of itself. And so creating a culture of belonging and having diversity as a big, and inclusion as two big pieces of the foundation of a culture of belonging, means that we're actually not just looking to say, hey, all right, we hired five black guys, two Mexican women, and a disabled guy who's a veteran, and then just ending your story there. It's about saying, hey, we hired these six people who have these amazing experiences and backgrounds. let's figure out how those help our team be better, how those help our team collaborate better, how we get all of those differences aligned into one single mission or one single vision. And so that's why I talk about this values piece being so important, because if an organization is clear about its values and it brings in people with diverse backgrounds, so that cognitive or thought diversity too, not just what you look like, and understand that now the work starts. It's not done because we hired a diverse group of people. That's what starts our process about now making our culture strong. And then in turn, our innovation, commitment, our collaboration stronger to deliver the types of outcomes we need, whatever they are. Maybe it's to go sell something, maybe it's to manufacture something, but you're going to do it at a better level once you have the strength of those people, because now they feel like they have a voice. They feel like they can work together to achieve goals, and you've empowered them to make decisions or share feedback, what I call constructive dissent. So like in that story you shared, I want somebody to tell me and to feel comfortable to tell me if they feel like we're going down a wrong path and they have data to support it. You don't need a solution yet. Just help me see something that's a blind spot for me. I don't want an hierarchical structure where because you feel fear to share with me, then somehow I might make a multi-million dollar mistake, right? Or potentially a mistake that costs lives, as opposed to having that environment where a person can feel comfortable, say, hey, so listen, we're all saying that this is great, but I see something here, let me share it with you. That's the culture to build, right? And so the diversity part of it and that culture of belonging starts with acknowledging differences and hiring differences as a culture add or something that adds to the capability of your team, not just makes it look different. Mm. I don't know if in the UK that's still like kind of as much of an issue around hiring practices involving diversity.
I think we're in the same boat. I think it's a big focus for us is that trying to have the right diversity in the right place. But I think exactly what you said there, we don't realize the actual potential of that, of those different cultures looking at things in different ways. And just being able to add that diversity of conversation, diversity of ideas. We literally exactly the same as what you were saying. We follow those very rudimentary kind of database sets. We have hired 6 Muslims and 4 Sikhs and 4 Christians and 7 Catholics, whatever, 4 white people. And you could go on and on and on all day. You know, what we don't then do is kind of utilize that within a business. And as you were talking, I was just thinking that there was this amazing bit in the same book from Matthew Syed that where they talk about they got a group of Japanese people and they got a group of American people, and they showed them a picture or a real fish tank, I can't remember. And the American people were asked to describe what they saw, and they spoke heavily about the fish that they saw. And then the Japanese people were said the same question, can you please describe what you saw? And they described the background, the surroundings, the context of the picture. And so if you just hired Americans in this one example, you're only ever going to see the fish.
Yeah.
If you just hire Japanese, you're only ever going to see the fish tank. You're never going to see the fish. But if you hire Japanese and American, you're going to get a full picture. And for me, I just read that and I thought, wow, one, what a fascinating bit of research that must have been to do. But two, such a simple way to put it, and to realize the immense power there. And you seem to be talking about exactly the same thing.
Oh, yeah.
So, and you kind of talk
I said, everything's been rewritten. It's just been written. Yeah. Now it's just getting rewritten.
Yeah, exactly that. And you talk about it being, it should be the number one priority in businesses in your book. Yeah. So, but businesses have got to make profit. They've got to, you know, they've got the health and safety guy banging on the door saying they need to do risk assessments, and they've got so many other priorities to do. You know, how and why should diversity? Well, we know why. We just spoke about it. But how do we prioritize that kind of inclusion and diversity?
Here's there's not really a short answer. I'll give the best I can here. So, you know, there was a study here done in America where 41% of managers came back and said that they're just too busy to build their culture. because they have too many other things that they have to do. Mm-hmm. And so that same study goes on to debunk that myth and through data in a lot of different ways. And I'll just share kind of the very brief highlights here. The first piece is they examined all of the time that leaders spend doing all of these other things that you mentioned, right? We've got these meetings we have to get to and these calls we have to be on and this product we have to this and this place we have to visit and do a site visit and the health and safety guy who wants to do this thing and my operations review that I have to prepare for. We've got all that going on. Every one of those things has one thing in common. They might have a couple, but they're pretty different categories, right? But they all have one thing in common. It requires people to get it done. And so when you think about if you are I'm going to use an American sports reference here. I apologize for this. But if you're a baseball pitcher in the National League, that means you don't hit, right? You don't hit. You have in the American League, you have a designated hitter who hits for you. You're just the guy throwing the ball. So how much time are you going to spend in the batting cage working on hitting? You're probably not going to spend a whole lot working on that one particular skill because your job, your thing, you're the pitcher. Until one day you get traded over to a different team in a different league and you have to be the guy who now hits, right? And you go, man, I really should have spent some time building this one fundamental skill that as a baseball player, everybody else on the team has. And I decided I wasn't going to build it. Well, so I use that example to kind of illustrate this idea that if people are at the core aspect of everything that you have to accomplish, whether it's your sales results or production results or anything else, and the team you lead are the folks who are getting that done, then how could anything be more important than sharpening that axe, right? That's the axe that's going to go chop down the tree is those people. Right. So if I'm worried about, man, I'm too busy because I have to really, you know, study this data and get a hold on the data so I can make sure that I can tell my team that they're not doing good so they can go do better. That is just wasted time. You can look at it and in a matter of a couple moments, know enough information to go ask some questions and figure out what you can do and where you can do it. So I guess the how is stop looking at outcomes before people. Look at people who are responsible to deliver those outcomes as your first priority. And I don't mean just, you know, high fives, right? That's not what I'm talking about. We can actually get shit done. We can really actually give good feedback, good coaching, understand real issues and problems. And then when we have a conversation with maybe that recruiter who is trying to find people to fill the position I have open, I take the extra 30 seconds or minute to lead with what I want to see from a culture standpoint or a background standpoint of an ideal candidate rather than just skills or capabilities, right? But something else that is going to add a dynamic to the team. So it's about do the same things you're already doing from an activity standpoint, focus on the people. And what you have then with empowered people is less mistakes being made, which means less messes to clean up. And those messes take time. Right? Which means less issues with results and performance that cause you to have to be on these extra calls or go to these extra meetings, which take time. So it's like, you know, I think we could use this example, right? I use a broken arm example. I think you have a Band-Aid example, but right. So if I have a broken arm and it's a compound fracture, the bone is poking out of my skin and I'm bleeding everywhere. And you come up to me and say, oh mate, I got this. And you wrap a bandage around my arm and my bleeding stops and you go, all right, back to work for you because you're not bleeding anymore. Like what the reality of that is just so asinine to think that would be the case. Everybody listening right now, it can follow where this is going because the reality is you have to treat what the real problem or what the real need is, right? And the real need is your people to be equipped, capable, innovative, collaborative, and trusting so they can actually do all the work that makes your life easier. Trust me, my number one job as a leader is to have my team so good they don't need me. They don't want me even, right? Because they're so good at what they're doing. And I know some leaders are afraid then that makes them obsolete or insignificant.
Yeah,
exactly. So now go get your promotion because you've done what it takes to create such a great thing here that you need to go replicate that in other or bigger places. So yeah, that should be your mission. Make yourself obsolete in this role so you can take on a bigger, more challenging, or different role.
Mm. That really kind of resonates for me when you said that about you kind of make your team really good so you become obsolete. I remember I was very, very young in my career, and I was kind of like the team leader in the health and safety team for this manufacturing facility, and we had this other lad start on a temporary contract, and he was awesome. And we'd been after an awesome assistant for a long time. We'd really struggled to get somebody. And I was very young, very naive, and sat with the managers. And they were all asking me, oh, what do you think of that other guy? I'm hearing a lot of good stuff. And I was like, yeah, he's all right. And they're like, but we're hearing loads of good about him. Like, what's going on? And I was like, he's all right, you know, get stuff done. And I was really kind of non-committal in my response, and one of the managers took me aside, caught me at the coffee machine or whatever later on, and just said, what's going on, James? And I said, like, he's good, like, he's really good. And like, and they were like, yeah, so, you know, use him and teach him the safety side, because he was very quality focused, so, you know, teach him the safety stuff. And I was like, I don't want to, because I was threatened by him as opposed to wanting him to be part of the team. I was threatened by him, and I remember that manager being like, you know, you're looking at it the wrong way. If you can bring that guy into the safety side and the team becomes better and you're the team leader, then we're going to be looking at you saying, wow, what a great job. And then he's going to jump up to your spot and you're going to jump up to the next spot. And I remember that conversation to this day and think about that, and that kind of resonated when you were telling that story there. Does this kind of stuff apply to like the smaller businesses as well? Like, you know, is it easier and is it harder for a smaller business compared to somebody that employs anything from 500 to 1,000 people, and then some guy that's just employing 20 people? Is any different? Is it the same?
Yeah, so fundamentally the principles are the same, but it is different. And does it apply? Yeah, it absolutely applies. Anytime that you are interacting or interfacing with other people, all of this is really important and really good stuff to think through and have as a plan in your organization, because everybody that I've ever met in a professional setting knows that they're capable of giving more than they give on any given day, on certain days, right?
Mm-hmm.
And knows that they have ideas that they haven't shared or haven't felt comfortable to share that would be helpful. And that same dynamic can exist in a small office. In fact, I have an example very recently. I was working with somebody. It's a team of six, right? The entire company is six people. And the founder, owner, he's the office bully, which is horrible, right? And so with a team of six, he's intimately, as the owner, involved in everybody's face every single day. And so you could do that and go about that in two different ways. Build an environment where people trust you as that leader and that owner who's in their business every day, and feel compelled and want to do such an exceptional job to either earn your praise or earn an opportunity. Or you can be that tyrant and that bully and that person who beats people down, and then you wonder why you constantly have turnover in your business, and you're always hiring people and you're never accomplishing the things you need to. And so that's one of the biggest places that this has a negative impact, because we haven't really talked about that yet. We've talked about the positive impacts, but the negative impact, and this is the same for large businesses, your best, most productive, most innovative, creative, and able people are the ones to leave first, because they won't put up with the bullshit. They know the value of their skills and their abilities, and they shop them out. And or they get recruited out, candidly. And so who's left? The people that you know, your middle 70%, and then the people that you're actively working to try and develop or move into another role, right? And so so you end up having this turnover at your most capable position. And if the old adage is true that 20% of the people do 80% of the work, guess what? It's that 20% that you're losing. So you're just constantly handicapping your business. So it's, is it more difficult in a large size business than versus a small size, to answer your question? It's more difficult to do it or as an entire organization when you have 10,000 people versus when you have even 100. 100 is much more manageable to do as an entire organization, because there is more opportunity to align and inspect and support and high five all those things that are going right. In a large organization of, say, 10,000, you end up with so many hands that are involved from the top down that could interpret the message a different way or not think it's important and do it differently or not do it at all, to where it does become a little bit of a challenge. And so there are certain building blocks we put in place in large organizations that aren't necessary in smaller organizations for it to have that work. But here's the reality. So you're listening to this, you are a manager in a large company, but you have a team of maybe 6 people or 10 people. That's all it takes, man. You can do this all on your own with your team of 6 or your team of 10. And people will be coming to you and they'll be asking you, why is your team doing so good? Why are these numbers so great? Why is this happening so perfectly? And then when you share the answer of what you're working on and building from a cultural perspective, certainly capable and well-intentioned other leaders, your peers, are going to learn from you and they're going to put it in place and share it. Share it. That's the other thing that some leaders don't do, is they don't share their best practices because they're afraid somebody else is going to outperform them. I say do it anyways, and if they outperform you, learn from them about what they tweaked to do a little bit better, and then you go take that, tweak that, and start doing better than them. I mean, I love competition. Competition is great. It's fun. It makes the work environment sometimes pretty cool. So share and compete with everybody having the same set of information to work from, and culture is that one that guaranteed all the time employees perform better, results are better. When that culture is intentional and it has that true sense of a feeling of belonging and trust, where collaboration and innovation can thrive.
Wow.
Sorry, man. I just dumped a whole bunch on you.
No, that was good. I was just sitting there like, that was good. That kind of thing you were talking about there about competition, you talk about like customer loyalty or customer belonging in your book. So like what's the difference? And, you know, with all that, yes, there is a lot of competition in nearly every game, you know, within within a safety game, you know, from my point of view, there is so many consultants out there, that are all competing for the slice of the pie. I've always said that there's a lot of people out there. It doesn't matter what you're selling. There's always going to be enough 9 times out of 10 for you to get your slice of the pie as well. However, how do you build that kind of loyalty, as I would say it, but for you, how do you make a customer kind of belong then? So would that come inherently from you making your employees belong? Like Richard Branson said, like, you focus on your staff first and they'll look after your customers. Is that the same kind of thing?
Yeah, Branson has that thing right for sure. I mean, that's a big, big, big statement, right? Meaning there's a lot of detail and work that goes making all that come together. And this is where now, like, so the belonging factor helps bring that tactical element to Branson's statement, right? And so the principles that I identified across leaders and brands that are incredibly successful are shared principles. The 5 principles I write in the book are shared between a brand, which is this kind of, you know, I don't know, institutional object, and leadership, which is a direct relationship with people. Because a brand, if you're doing it right, is just a relationship with people. So I use a couple of different examples in the book. One of them, though, when it comes to the brand and building loyalty, right, building a customer base that is never going anywhere, even if you piss them off, they're not leaving, right? And so the example I use is a company called SJC Drums. They're out of Massachusetts here in the U.S., and it's a drum manufacturer, like musical instruments, right? And they're competing in a space where, you know, you think about the product they sell. Like, they sell a very high-end custom product. People pay, you know, $8,000 for, or whatever that is, like 10,000 pounds or something, for a drum set. That sounds crazy, right? And they buy one or maybe two in their lifetime. You know, it's not like they're going bad, right? And so you're talking about this idea of forming a relationship with somebody to give them, to have them give you your money once, maybe twice in their life for something. But SJC has gone about this in such a crazy cool way about building what they call their family. It's not their customers, it's their family. And they've intentionally built a community both online and offline where customers of this brand get together and they collaborate and they share their stories and their ideas. And the company is active in those communities, whether, again, it's online like on Facebook or it's offline at events or other things that happen, where they are soliciting ideas and they're listening and they're offering ideas and solutions back to folks. That is so critical in the first step where people feel like there's this, you know, just calling them family doesn't work. You actually have to treat it that way, right? You have to listen and respect and share and also collaborate and high five, you know? So the reality is those principles of building community and really defining what our identity is and our behaviors are and empowering people and giving people a voice and bringing diverse groups together and then figure out how to highlight all of the diverse backgrounds as strengths that people can learn from and share from and collaborate with. All of that stuff is the exact same for a leader and a brand. And so when you talk about building loyal customers, and I said, you know, even if you piss them off, I mean, you still have to take care of them and correct the situation. But some companies don't have that fortunate relationship with their customers. So if you upset them once, they're gone, even if you make it right. And so one of the biggest things that companies have to not do is compete on price, right? And because competing on price ultimately ends up being good for consumers in short term, but is terribly handicapping to businesses in general, and sometimes industries, right? And so the best way to not have to compete on price is to create an environment where your people feel so compelled to be a part of your organization. Harley Davidson's another one, right? Harley Davidson motorcycles. People put the tattoo of the Harley Davidson logo on their body. Yeah. Why do they do that? Do they do it because they love their Harley Davidson that they bought so much? Maybe, but not usually. They put it on their arm somewhere that's just below their sleeve, somewhere where people can see it. So people know that they're a Harley rider because they want to be part of that community, part of that family. And do you think that person is ever going to buy another bike besides Harley in their life? Absolutely not.
I think a great example of what over here in the UK would be Volkswagen. We've got quite a big Volkswagen community locally to me in, where is it? I can't remember the name of the place now. Anyway, there's like a racetrack locally, and they always have a Volkswagen festival every year. And the amount of people, the local villages are just full. Like if I go out on my bike around the VW festival, there's just campers and Beetles everywhere, and the roads are just full of them. And you just think, God, that's some loyalty to a brand. Like some people, exactly the same as Harley Davidson people, some of these people get tattoos of that VW circle on there, and you just think, wow, that's just phenomenal. How do you get that kind of loyalty? And I suppose that is the kind of question. Do you start with your staff first? Do you focus on developing loyalty within your business first, and then that will just become infectious and spread?
It's an and, not a or, okay. Or not a plus, but it's an and, because if truly you've done the first step, which is identifying and understanding what your values truly are. So like SJC, the company, I gave you the example from, their values, quality, culture, and identity, right? So that's the basic principles of their values. And so everything has to align with the highest quality, period. That means not just the drum that they manufacture, and not just the supplier they get it from, and not just the equipment, machinery they purchase to, you know, make the products, but also the interactions that they have with each other, right? And then so they have ways to measure the quality of meetings, for example, when they do meetings. And so it starts with defining that, because once you define that, then you can start to lay out what the behaviors are that exist in your organization that support those. And so you'll identify within the marketing and PR departments and advertising departments all of the behaviors that should exist that don't just regulate how those employees interact and interface with each other and with their employer, but also it informs very clearly how the brand then, who these people drive, right? How the brand interfaces and interacts with the community and with prospective customers and with government or, you know, whatever your other stakeholders potentially might be who are your customers or folks that you've influenced with. And so it's an and it all stems from the alignment of those values first and very clearly defining those and then creating the definitions of what the behaviors look like to have the actual impact. So it's not one first and then the other. Certainly, you don't look after your employees and your employees aren't going to look after your customers. Branson was totally right about that, but both can happen and must happen simultaneously. And when they don't, that's where you have the opportunity to start to figure out why.
I 100% agree. I'm just kind of trying to put myself in the position of, say, like a CEO of, let's say a car or motorbike company that wants to be the next Harley Davidson, that wants to be the next Volkswagen, create that kind of community, that loyalty within and without, so their customers and their staff. And they're kind of thinking, well, that's all well and good. I know my values, but how can I get, say, a cleaner of the offices, align their values to my values, or the strategic management team? They're all in a very specific role. They're there for a very specific reason. They've probably spent their life trying to become a strategic manager within the board, and they become inherently very passionate about that. But a lot of people in these kind of manual labor roles are there because they just need a job. They want to go in, get a job done, and go home. You could say the same for forklift driver, you know, pick and packer in a warehouse, whatever. They just want to go in, get a job done. How do you align values of two inherently really different roles in a business?
Yeah, so I don't know if I could give you the exact same, you know, alignment of values with the CEO who maybe is worried about his vacation to Bali and the guy who's just trying to put food on his table and get his son to university or something, right? Yeah. So, but what I can tell you is something I learned from an experience I had very early on in my leadership career, and one that I definitely believe is something that makes sense for the question you asked here. So I learned very early on that even though I was managing salespeople who you would think would be motivated just by earning a lot of money and having lots of money, that wasn't necessarily a motivator for everybody. And while it was for some, others maybe were more motivated by getting recognition for being a top performer. Well, when you have then everybody else in the middle, what do you do? So going back to your question, what I learned was coaching to an outcome for the business and quit talking to people about, you know, an outcome for their work product and start talking to them about their lives. So this is where it comes in for both a laborer and a CEO. What do you want to accomplish in your life? And I'm going to help you do whatever it takes to help you be able to accomplish that. So maybe you're a laborer. And actually, let me just use the example that I had from my learner. So I sat and I talked with one of my employees, Jessica. She wasn't performing particularly well for an extended period of time. And I talked to her about what she wanted to do in her life and what she wanted to accomplish. And keep in mind, this was a sales role, so they can increase their compensation. And so I talked to her about these things, and she said, well, she wanted to buy a boat because she likes getting out on the lake and going boating. I said, well, fantastic. Let's work out a plan to get there. And so we worked on what her financial goals would need, her earnings would need to be able to afford a boat. And then once she did get the boat, she needed to get a truck to be able to tow the boat to the lake and drop it in. So we worked on that. And then fast forward like another year, and we were still working together, and everything was doing great. She's consistently making all this extra money now, and she's happy with what she's doing because she has this happy life outside of work. Now she wanted to buy a house, and she needed a house that was big enough to have a place to park her boat. So we worked on a financial plan to do that. So it's the same thing. Find out what the intrinsic underlying important things are. So for a CEO, maybe it's getting recognition publicly to be able to be able to sit on some boards that the CEO wants to sit on of some other companies. Maybe that's a motivation. And so some of that comes from the results of the organization, but others of it comes from his own or her own personal profile, right? So they're building up their profile. So things that can align with the company doing great, them doing some sort of philanthropic or other work that or the company also doing it at the direction, that all blends in together and helps elevate that outcome that that CEO wants, but also helps what the organization is wanting to do. Same thing for a laborer. Showing up, do your job. Okay, that's great, but you have things you want to accomplish. And if you just showed up and did your job perfectly for the next 10 years and stayed in the role for the next 10 years, you know, your income's going to stay relatively the same, adjusted for inflation. What are these things you want to accomplish, whether it's financial or it's time off or it's some other things that they would like to be able to do in their lives? And then figuring out a way to connect those, that result or that outcome, into those things that are available as opportunities at work. Not just what's in front of them for the job they're doing now, but maybe working a little bit harder, a little bit more dedicated, or a little bit more closely to it to get the next job that is going to help them do that thing that they want to do. Even if that next job is out of your company, by the way. Even if that next job is out of your company, because you're going to get the benefit of an incredibly loyal person who may not want to leave you, but you've developed their skills and capabilities to a place where you don't have a role for them anymore, and they're better off going somewhere else. You're going to have an advocate out there who's going to just talk so favorably about your company, and they're going to send you highly qualified referrals when something comes their way. And and by the way, you have the benefit of them being a so much better employee and more productive person during the time you have them. So don't be afraid to promote somebody outside of outside of your company, if you know what I mean. Promote them out of the capability of working for you. That is a testament to the true character of a belonging factor leader.
Mm. It's kind of reminiscent of like that kind of karma piece, isn't it? If you kind of coach somebody, mentor them, and let them go, and you know, eventually it's going to come back round and repay. You know, you're paying it forward in a way, aren't you?
Yeah, and even if it doesn't come back around in any way that you can identify, that's great too, because you were true to your values as a leader. You created a situation where a person is better off. Well, you helped them create a situation where they're better off, and you got the benefit of all of their work product during the time you had them. Like that can never be the wrong decision, never. And by the way, so now to align that to the CEO, the CEO got this one person. And we're just using an example of one. Theoretically, it's spread across the organization. But the CEO got the benefit of this one person kind of working above their pay, if you will, right? Doing more than they had been doing for the same amount of money. Beautiful. Love it.
And I think there's part of it to is also just that kind of, I can't think of the word, but it reminds me of doing this podcast. You get the odd person that says something nice on LinkedIn or Twitter, shares it and says good podcast or whatever, and that's really, really nice, and you think wow. But I'm the one thing that kind of really sticks out to me, there's one gentleman sent me a message, and he said he loved my podcast, and he listened to my podcast on the way to, well, actually he was listening to my podcast and he was going to a job interview in a couple of days. He wanted some advice. I gave him some advice. It's the first time anyone's ever asked me for advice. And I was really quite proud of myself that somebody, you know, felt they could ask me for advice. And that was a big moment for me. And I felt really invested in this young man now, like straight away, and gave him advice. And he went away. He got the job, but he messaged me the day after either the interview or got the job. I can't remember. But he said he listened to my podcast on the way and used bits from my podcast to use in the interview. And he just wanted to say thank you. And I remember saying to my wife, I was buzzing like for like 4 days. I could have been high on life. I literally was just loving life. For me, even now, thinking about that, it makes me so happy. And it's that kind of piece you were saying there, like, it's not necessarily maybe that monetary value you get back, but that kind of inner feeling that, wow, I helped somebody. For me, it didn't matter. I wasn't getting paid for the podcast. It didn't matter how many people listened to me anymore. It didn't matter how many shares, likes, downloads, whatever. It was gone. All I could think was, wow, that guy, I helped him get a job, and that was just phenomenal. It was amazing.
That's a wonderful story, man. And, you know, so one thing that comes to my mind as you're sharing that story is not everybody listening has that same wiring, internal wiring, to where that is something that feels good and charges you up for 4 days. Mm. And that's a big part of this idea of diversity, too, is that that's okay if a person is kind of selfish and kind of not a big pay it forward type of person. That's mm-hmm. okay for a person to be that way in the context of a work environment, because not everybody's wired the same. So it's mm-hmm. still about finding out, though, what it is that person is wired to enjoy, and look for a way to help that be something that you can create more of in their life, in how you coach them, how you work with them, how you support them as a leader. And so, you know, if you're in a leadership position and you don't have any of that wiring, I'll tell you right now, just my opinion, supported by data, you were probably in the wrong job. A leader is a people first position. You are a person who leads humans to deliver outcomes. Other than that, you're just a manager, and maybe you're a manager of processes, and that's okay too. But if you have people you look after, sharpening that people skills axe and making that axe ready to go is the most important thing that you can do. Because if your people leave and you're stuck with bad ones, unproductive ones, and people who don't like you or respect you, you're not a leader anymore, right? Mm. Leaders are not people who have titles. Leaders are people who have followers.
Definitely, 100%. I'm conscious that we are going on for a time, but there are a couple of things that I want to touch on. You kind of talk about privilege quite heavily in your book. You've got a whole chapter kind of dedicated to that, quite candid in that as well. Like, do you want to touch briefly on that? What privilege means to you? Why it got a whole chapter?
Yeah, it did get a whole chapter, and here's why. So, as a straight white man in America. You know, I'm in the historical majority of all kind of power roles and decision making in my country. And, you know, unless you are, you know, that kid who grew up with your parents, you know, super wealthy parents or something, telling you that you have all this power and privilege. And you grew up with that, which I don't think most people are, then, you know, so like for me, I was unaware of all of the benefit that necessarily provided me, all of the advantages that I potentially had for nothing that I did, just something that was done for me, right? You asked me my story of how I got here, and you know, it's funny, I'll circle back to that. I got here because of no decision of my own. I got here because of my parents, right? Mm. And my parents were both white, and I happened to be straight, and all of those things happen, and so now I'm this white, straight male in America. And there were these moments that it really started to kind of hit me upon reflection of where I might have had an advantage or an opportunity that somebody else didn't have, just because of that. And one of those was actually in boot camp in the Navy. I was a person who was in what we call the Sea Cadets. It's kind of like a, I don't know, imagine like a Boy Scout for...
Yeah, we have the same over here.
Okay, beautiful. And so, you know, and so I ended up as a Sea Cadet, then going into the Navy, and... They were trying to choose the people in charge of us boot camp, the drill instructors, to choose who would be the recruit leader. And they chose me because I was a sea cadet. And so then I started kind of leading them. And I was talking to and getting to know everybody else in my boot camp division. And I found out that there was another dude there. He happened to be Hispanic. He was also in Sea Cadets for longer than me. He outranked me. He was in better physical condition than me. His ASVAB score, the military test that you take to get in, was higher than mine. So by all of those kind of objective metrics on paper, he might have been the guy. He probably should have been the guy to lead us. Mm. And my two drill instructors were both white men. So I didn't see this or really recognize this in the time, but upon reflection, I realized I was awarded that position when really nothing that they were evaluating that I could tell put me ahead of him, except for the fact that I look like them. Mm. And so I bring this up and I write about it in the book because there's an importance of what I call allyship, or being a person who looks for opportunities to recognize something that is wrong, or that is, in this case, you know, I'm talking about privilege that gave an advantage to me, which means disadvantage to others, and be an ally for those who may be disadvantaged. Be an ally for that person who has shared with you as a peer that they have these ideas about how something could change at work, but they're too afraid to, or they don't feel like they can explain it to somebody who would maybe actually listen to it. So be an ally for them, particularly if that person is somehow on the other side of the opportunity divide, right? And maybe you're a white guy. And so maybe they're going to listen to you even though they won't listen to him. Is that fair? Hell no. But does that mean you can do something about it and start to use your privilege as something that can help others? And more importantly, if it's something that helps make your job easier, be selfish about it, you know, share it, right? And help this person share it, more importantly. Don't just take it from them and run with it, but help them share it. And sometimes that means, as a person who has some privilege, sometimes it means that you have to be the one to at least open the door to the idea, and then you can usher them along. But, you know, racism, sexism, ageism, all of those things are things that are prevalent across societies and communities across the world. And so it's about if you are in a position of privilege, no matter what your community or society is. I explained mine in America as being a white male, but it could be different depending on where you live in the world. If you are in that position of privilege, understand that that can be a tool for others and should be a tool for others. Because it doesn't just help them, it helps you.
Well, fair play for kind of trying to address what is a massive international controversial subject in a book about leadership, where a lot of people would probably just avoid that and just be like, nah, I'm not going to talk about privilege. So fair play to you for kind of addressing that.
Yeah, man, I'll tell you, there was some debate about whether or not that chapter stayed. To me, it's too important. They go hand in hand, because how can you talk about this idea of building these things that sound very utopian and very, you know, aspirational and difficult to achieve without starting to talk about the fact that there are people with privilege and power who can actually do something about it, and it doesn't mean that they have to be the CEO or the vice president or whoever. They can be, without question, any of us at any time for the right reasons.
Yeah, you kind of have to acknowledge it to be able to kind of move past it in a way, or embrace it and kind of use it, like you were saying.
Yeah, man, absolutely. And anybody who tells you in Western society that being white and male is not a privilege is completely out of touch or blatantly lying.
Definitely.
So use that to your advantage. Use that to not just your advantage, but the advantage of others, which helps actually give you an advantage, because it's way cooler to be cool than to be a dick.
What a great way to finish. And I think maybe we leave it at that, a virtual high five. It's a great conversation. And by the fact that we've gone over our hour, and I've still got things that I think, I'd love to talk about this, I'd love to talk about that. So maybe we get you back on. But if people are loving this conversation as much as I am, they think, I need this book, I need to talk to Devin, I need to find out more. Why don't you tell us just quickly about what you are, what your business is, and how they can get a copy of your book or find out more about you and your business?
Yeah, absolutely. So a few things. I think we can put a link in your show description where maybe we could give away a couple free autographed copies of the book to your listeners. I think that would be super rad. Yeah. So I don't have the link off the top of my head, but I'm sure we'll have this in the show notes. So if you want to get an autographed copy of the book, go there, fill out your email address. We'll contact you if you're the winner and send you a book. But if you want to check it out yourself, Amazon.com or co.uk, as it were, and you will search for Belonging Factor, and you will definitely find the book out there. It's in every possible format that I could get them to produce it. So so however you like to consume it, it's there. And find me on LinkedIn. LinkedIn is a great way to connect with me. I'm very active in LinkedIn. So Devin, Devin Halliday, also the link I'm sure we can have in the show notes you want to do that. I am actually doing a lot of work coming up in the next year in the UK and in England with conferences and working with some clients. So no matter where you're located, it is not too far away for us to do some work together.
Awesome. Yeah, I might hit you up when you come over to America. We'll have a coffee or a beer and continue the conversation.
Yeah, let's have a pint.
For sure. You can have some proper beer over here in the UK. Not like that you drink over there.
Jesus Christ. Hey, listen, I'm game for whatever. I love learning about other cultures, other people, and figuring out how to impart my American values upon you.
I'll bring out our inner Americans.
We will high five. We will high five.
Amazing. We will drop all the links, especially a link to a free copy of the book, in the autograph copy of the book, in the description, and your LinkedIn and absolutely everything that we can, we'll drop in the description. So Devin, thank you so much for an awesome conversation, and like I say, hopefully we'll maybe get you back on in the future, and hopefully people go and get a copy of your book.
Yeah, I'd love to. Absolutely. Thanks for the gift of your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. Have a good night.
All right.
Okay, guys, I hope you found that conversation interesting, useful on how to create a belonging culture in your business. I think Devin really articulates his book and the building of a belonging culture really, really well, really clearly. He's got a great personality that comes off really, really well. Don't forget to get in the link in the description and get a free copy of your book, people. I've got it. It's a great book. So get your copy, get reading. Once you finish reading it, let me know. If you do get a free copy, once it's delivered, take a photo of it and tag me in the post. Put it on Facebook at Rebranding Safety. Put it on LinkedIn, tag James McPherson. Put it on Twitter at Rebranded Safety. Come and find us and let us know you've got the book. Once you've finished, let us know how it is as well. If you listen on YouTube, don't forget to hit that subscribe button and the bell so you never miss another episode. Whatever platform you're listening on for the podcast, don't forget to hit subscribe if you can. If you can give us a rate and review, we would absolutely love that as well. Please help us help other people. Share this podcast, people, because it is the best health and safety podcast out there. It's modern, it's entertaining, and we got awesome people and sometimes some amazing giveaways like today. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. I'll catch you next week. Safe.